So, hello and welcome back to the Open Science Radio. This is kind of a special episode. Lately, we have a lot of special episodes, I'm just thinking. But we will get back to the normal episodes in air quotes. Today, I'm not alone. I have a guest because of the content of this episode. Because the content of this episode is actually a contribution. It's not us behind it, basically. We are just doing a short introduction to give you a better context of what you're about to hear. And in order to do so, I gladly invited Lindsay. Hi, Lindsay.
Hi, nice to meet you.
We have met briefly before, I think on one of the Barcamp, Open Science Barcamps.
Yes, we did back in March 2017.
I think so, yes. Yeah. And I assume that at least the people in Berlin involved into any kind of science communication would probably have stumbled upon your name in any kind of connection.
Yeah, I have been doing multiple different things in Berlin. So I've been helping out at neuroscience conferences, working for a art science festival, and also hosting science communication workshops in Berlin. Yeah.
So before we actually get to this episode, which was contributed basically by you and a couple of workshop students, I call them, do you want us to give us a bit of your own personal background, how you got into this whole topic?
Sure. I guess I've been interested in science communication since I was a PhD student and realized how my images of neurons were so such a good spark of interest for people to get into science. I found that people would look at my images and then they were green and red fluorescent images and they would start asking me questions about them. And that's where I realized that art is actually a really great way to captivate people, and then they become more interested in it because they have a hook. And so then I became interested in just all sorts of alternative science communication methods, you could say, rather than just the presenting. And so then I started hosting some science communication workshops myself after getting some experience. And this was the product of one of those workshops.
Cool. How, as I understand, this workshop was taking place basically at the Humboldt University in Berlin. How did you get to work there or host a workshop there?
So I had a friend working as an English teacher in the English speaking department, and they have a lot of science graduate students who also speak English as a second language. And so they wanted some experience to practice using their scientific language while speaking English. And so I was looking for ways to get them speaking, ways to get them writing, and making a podcast was a great option for me.
Yeah, cool. So how was the audience for you in that case? I mean, what were the participants of this workshop?
They were all science graduate students themselves. Some of them were very close to finishing their PhD, and they were interested in maybe starting getting into science communication as a field of, as a career field for themselves. And so this was a really great workshop for them to just be exposed to all the different types of science communication that are out there right now. And what I really liked was giving them the opportunity to try their hands at it rather than just learning from listening and watching other people, to actually just go and try it.
Would you say that they already had a kind of an underlying idea of what science communication is all about, or that it might be an essential part of actually research activities?
Yeah, as PhD students in science, I think they've all come across the, the difficulty, the challenge of communicating what they are researching, as well as the importance of it. So everybody came in already interested in science communication. But it was fun. In the very beginning, we actually had a debate of what the purpose of science communication was and what the definition was and what the importance of it was. And it was interesting how we all think we are talking about the same thing. And it turns out people have different views of what exactly is their responsibility as a scientist.
Which is kind of what we as science communicators educators in the widest sense are basically debating with our clientship all day long, right? The how much you need to communicate, through what means and channels you need to communicate, or you want to communicate, or it might be best to communicate. So it's actually a really good way to probably start early talking about this.
Yeah, just as a reminder of what they're getting into and sort of setting themselves up for after graduation. Yeah. It was a really good timing.
So what we are about to hear is basically three interviews from different contexts. And I think that makes it really interesting, because what we also will hear is a perspective from students, basically, and what their how they perceive open science and open access. And what we will hear is mainly positive thoughts, I think, but also some of the arguments that we are used to hearing, how much open you should be when you're working on something very specific, something very new. So it's actually really nice to have those three perspectives. And it is really, really much appreciated that you're doing workshops in giving people not only the chance to try out new tools and get used to writing, speaking, recording, but also give us the chance to participate and have a listen to the final result.
Yeah, thank you.
Before we head into the interview, do you have anything to contribute?
I think one important thing to point out is that these interviews are not in a linear form, that they are sort of mixed up. And that was because even though we were interviewing three very different people with different takes on open science, I found that they had themes that really related well to each other. There was a philosophical thread going on, sort of a more practical company thread, and then also the student perspective. And just so that the listener is aware that these are not linear interviews.
Yeah. One last question that comes to my mind, because it took me a while to get used to it, and I'm probably still not used to it. How do your students react to the medium of a podcast and hearing their own voice and listening to themselves in this interview situation?
I think they were definitely awkward when we first were listening through it, because we did a lot of listening to try to piece the different parts together. Yeah. But I think after, 5 minutes, you get used to the sound of your voice. You may still not like it, but at least you get over giggling and everything. Yeah.
I mean, you get used to pain as well, so.
Yeah, exactly.
Okay, Lindsay, thank you very much for A, contributing, and B, asking or answering my couple of questions. And good luck with any kind of workshops you might have in the future. And maybe we meet again at some Barcamp or conference.
Yeah, sounds great. Thank you very much, Matthias. And I wish you the best luck as well.
Thank you. Bye. And for all you listeners of the Open Science Radio, have fun with this episode.
Hello, and welcome to today's Experimental Science Communication episode, hosted at Humboldt University in Berlin. My name is Lindsay Petley-Reagan, and today you will hear the final product of three interviews conducted by Paul Rickheit, Gina Dorfholz, and Katja Katz, focusing on the topic of open science. The philosophical, entrepreneurial, and student perspectives here have been blended together to create one experiential dialogue generated specifically for this podcast.
Hello, this is Katja Katz. I will be discussing the possible future of the Flusser Archive, focusing on the question of open access and open science during this interview with Dr. Anita Iori, scientific supervisor of the Flusser Archive. Hi, Anita. I'm
Hi.
Really happy to have you here.
Yeah, and thanks a lot that you are doing this interview with me. So about my background, I studied history and applied linguistics. And actually, I came across with the archive, where I started to work in the archive as an intern. And I just finished my PhD on electronic music. And about the open science, or like the background is here, especially in the Flusser archive, I think it's a very, very interesting topic. First of all, because of Flusser's own theories on on the dialogue and on dialogue and on discourse generally, because if you know a little bit about Flusser or Flusser's communication theory, you know that Flusser differentiated in between two types of communication, the discourse and the dialogue. And for him, within the dialogue and in his book, in the Communicologie, he writes about the network dialogue and about the circle dialogue. And for him, the circle dialogue is kind of, in a way, a problematic because the information is just circulating always in the same way, like within the small cycle, like what we are doing now.
Yes.
But it will change to network dialogue when, in the moment, when you put it online, and then people will listen to it, and they can add their comments and their own feedback and their own opinions about this whole composition what we have here now. So actually, Flusser had this kind of idea that that's the future of the communication in the end. But the dialogue itself, so to say, this futuristic network dialogue cannot work without the discourse. And for him, the discourse, for example, the best example for discourse is science itself.
Hello, my name is Paul Rieckheit, and today I'm talking to Dr. Annemarie Lang, the CEO of Animage, about open science and about how her platform aims to reduce animal research. Hello, Annemarie. First of all, maybe introduce yourself and tell us a little bit about your background.
Thank you for this invitation. So I started to work in science during my study on veterinary medicine. And during this time, or during my time in research, I also recognized that there's a common problem within science. So when you go to the lab, you can see some researchers working with mice only taking out the brain and the rest goes to the waste. You go some labs down the floor and you see other researchers working mainly with the liver and put the rest to the waste. So and then you think, okay, this can be done better because at the end you have a huge amount of waste, but no solution. And what it's missing is a kind of information infrastructure. And this is what we want to provide with Animage. So I started Animage beside my normal work as a scientist. And we provide a platform where you can share your animals, so mainly the tissue and organs of sacrificed animals from research.
So in essence, Animage is kind of an open animal platform where researchers can share animals that they work with, share tissues, share organs, and kind of openly work together and request different material. So in essence, there's kind of the thoughts behind open science are reflected in this platform. Where would you say you see kind of connections between the idea of open science and what Animage can provide?
So I think it's definitely a good part within open science, or it goes directly in the direction of open science, because you can share your tissue and organs. You can also share animals that you're having an experimental procedure if someone else needs it or has another approach for this kind of disease or this kind of modified gene or something like this. So another point is that you get into contact with other researchers working with animals, for example, so you also get their exchange. And yes, you have also to be really open about what you did with the animals, mm-hmm. because otherwise the other researcher who is using the materials at the end cannot really somehow analyze the tissue.
Hello, this is Gina. In today's interview with Patricia and Tobias, we are going to discuss the topic of open science in general. Patricia studied biology and neurosciences and is about to finish her PhD in the next year. As a researcher at Freie Universität Berlin, she is dealing with growth factor signaling in the context of breast cancer and mesenchymal cell differentiation. Tobias also studied biology and started his PhD at the beginning of last year, focusing on clinical immunology in the context of rheumatic diseases and allergies at the Deutsche Römer Forschungszentrum Charité Berlin. And I'm really happy to welcome Patricia and Tobias.
Hi.
Hi, Gina.
Well, let's start with what do you think is open science for you and why are you interested in that topic?
So open science for me in my, let's say, PhD day-to-day life normally is When I, for example, do my literature research and check for new publications, and I see that I cannot access the publication because the free university doesn't have the license. Or, for example, I want to reproduce some data of a publication or use the same method, and I can't really get the details of the protocol because the materials and methods part of that paper is very, very brief, and there's no details at all. And for me, that's actually the opposite of open science. And on the other hand, on special occasions, for example, during talks or in international conferences, I have the feeling that more open science would also be good, because there it's more about the presentation of data, and sometimes you have just a bit the feeling that the other person is a little bit, let's say, paranoid and doesn't want to talk about their recent findings because you work on the same topic maybe.
Okay, thank you very much. And Tobias, what's your opinion?
So, in general, open science for me is having access to most or almost all data, especially without having to pay for it. Data should not be sealed behind money.
Okay, so obviously you have been confronted with the topic of open science before, and you also mentioned already some advantages and disadvantages. So in general, do you like the concept of open science, which means that your science or the science of someone else is made accessible to society?
I like the concept very much. Because I mostly only see advantages. Again, I think my point of view is from a perspective that I don't have a lot of other researchers working on my topic, but I think I see the advantages that there's more collaboration, international collaboration.
Well, I think this concept is sort of a two-edged sword. On the one hand, of course, it's great to have access to data. On the other hand, I would also be sort of hesitant to give away my thoughts or my ideas before.
Flusser wrote his book The Shift in the 80s and end of 80s, and to that, in the original publication or in the first version, that was a floppy disk added to this publication. And this floppy disk idea was that you have this floppy disk at home. It's the electronic. It's actually ebook before ebook. So you could put it into your computer and read exactly the same content what was in the book, in the Shift. And you could add your own comments to that. And that was, again, this Flusserian dialogic comment with the Flusser hypertext, which is one step higher with this ebook. It's not an ebook, it's a multimedia study system, so to say. It's hypertext before hypertext.
Before text mining.
Exactly, totally. There, the idea was that there was even an option where you could print it out and send back your own opinions to the publishing house. And then publishing house would give it to the professor, so to Flusser, and he could answer to the reader and send it in an analog way back per post to the people.
So in moving ahead to making science more open, from your personal experience and your research, have you ever faced any obstacles when you said, okay, I want to try to be more open as a researcher?
We are also really happy that our institute is also some kind of supporting this by via funding, because you have to pay a lot more for open access than for normal publication. This can be some kind of a challenge for other groups, but this is not in our case. Challenge within research that you are ranked due to your impact factors and the funding that you got during the last year, for example. And this is really difficult then to be open, because when someone else use your data or your idea and is publishing first, for example, then you lose everything.
I think the biggest obstacle is that we would all have to do exactly the same in order to make it work. And on the other hand, of course, it's all about money. The idea of working in science is to like find out things, develop new therapies, for example. But on the other hand, it's of course also a job. We need to make money somehow, and yeah, using ideas and research results to get a hand on patents or other like possible sources of income is of course something that's very tempting for a lot of people, and I think it's a big obstacle for open science.
So like Toby just said, if not everyone is participating equally, then there are problems. So one of the obstacles is that there are definitely always people or labs or even institutes that won't participate, which then either probably have the advantage that other people share their data and they don't.
I personally, I'm afraid that someone might pick up the ideas and someone who has maybe better like better models, better ways of showing what I want to show, and maybe he could do it just faster. And
well, so referring to the obstacles, do you have some ideas of how you could use tools or policies to help those or yourself embracing open science?
A way to protect just the idea of doing something, or just to give them credit afterwards, not in terms of money or anything, but just so that the people who shared their ideas are really then incorporated into the final study or the final result, which is maybe then like published by someone else.
The whole system has to change. You need new ranking systems, new credit systems, for example. Also in the context with alternative methods, for example, or education, when you think about training people to be more aware of what they are doing, for example, in the animal model, so to also reduce the animal number, to refine, to apply pain medication and something like this. You can also think about a credit system, because normally the researchers don't want to do it or do not have really the time to do it, because they do not get any credit for this. They only get the credit for the publication at the end.
Animage as a platform helps move science more into the digital world. It's an online platform. It's an application. How do you think that the internet, the World Wide Web, is gonna influence science and especially open science in the future? Do you have any trends that you feel that are gonna come up?
And you only look as ResearchGate. It's somehow old now, but also the approach of ResearchGate is to go away from the normal impact factors to more a sharing community, meaning if you answer to the question that are posted into a forum, then you get more points, for example, so you get credits when you share your experience, for example. But then you can also look on all the open access journals that you now have, so you have a much more greater opportunity to get a lot of information. But you also have a problem with so much information, meaning there are also other things coming up in really large projects worldwide where they try to keep a network or to produce a network, and they are only working due to the World Wide Web. So I think it really does a lot, and yeah, I'm looking forward to it.
Go definitely to the direction, or like at least that's my opinion, to even more and more and more open and more things online and more things open to everyone. Everyone, in a sense, who has access to the internet. So it's we should never forget this very small fact that more than half of the world still doesn't have access to the internet. So I think it's again a critical thing about this whole utopistic idea about internet and networks. On the other hand, as I mentioned, Flusser is also fascinated by the new technological inventions and bringing this new technology into the whole way of dialogue. This is again the next step. And then in the end, the aim will be that one day, due to keywords, how you can search within this system, you can add your own comments, and this is again very Flusserian. We are an archive. We always say that it's, yeah, archive, that's the name of it, but it's more like a research platform.
So I think with such a platform as Animage is, you also somehow trigger a more open thinking or open mindset towards such new innovative ways of doing things within research. Another thing is what we want to include within the platform is some kind of a forum or exchange platform, especially for experience with different animal models. So because sometimes it's also really difficult for someone who's starting with this animal experiment and do not have a lot of experience to find someone else. Another thing is to be, for example, really open when you go on conferences or something like this, or when you write grants. So also this is somehow open science.
For example, at conferences, to really openly share your things, it would be easier if there's always a policy of not photographing and not recording talks or posters. I've been to a conference where that was the case, and that facilitated the discussions, I think. The people were more open, because if you only hear it, you cannot really reproduce it.
I think for Flusser, this kind of the network dialogue and then this whole era about open access or like giving out information and people can give kind of feedback and own opinion or adding to it is super important.
When you are passionate about your idea, then you will be really happy to have a group with the same idea and to work towards the common goal at the end. And I think you will be much more faster than today, where you do it all in parallel. To join forces is definitely another point.
Could you shortly paint us a picture of what you think or what you would like academia and open science to be within the next 50 years? So I would very much like, as I already mentioned, that all journals are open access, and that as a normal student who's dependent of the licenses of the university that you're enrolled in, you can really read everything that's out there. And not only a few hand-picked journals, let's say, that the university pays off. So that would be great, and I think also manageable in 50 years.
I think it will be much more opener than today, because what is coming up is a new generation of scientists, a little bit more younger than us, because they are directly trained in sharing. Think about Instagram, Facebook. They grew up with all these platforms sharing everything, their whole life and all personal details. So they are a little bit more in this open thinking and this mindset than the old generation is, I think. So there will be definitely a shift. I think perhaps in the future that you will have really big data computers where you only put in your results and you get out your paper at the end without doing anything, and which directly loads your data up to a database, and someone else is putting in his data or her data and it's combined with yours, and then it come out a next publication or something like this. Perhaps this is the future of open science, and
sounds great.
Yeah.
And, of course, a very hot topic for us is what's the future of an archive, generally. Like, can we put everything, all information, all the documents, manuscripts, book manuscripts, essays, and all those things what we have here online, and then giving it to people, and people can add comments and give their opinions to that and so on. Should we do that or should we not do that? That's, of course, another question for us too, because I think, and I'm probably not the only one person with this opinion who work at different archives, that future archives or the archives generally kind of have to go with the new technological inventions and go with the flow, and being opened to these new inventions, because in the end, we are sitting here with a closed room and sitting on top of on our documents, so to say, and not sharing it with anyone.
I don't really think that in 50 years we will have access to data and ideas and concepts before a written final paper has been published. I must admit I wouldn't put my ideas out there. Although my project also benefited a lot from open data. Some data that have been published quite a while ago, but I think in my case it's a bit different because I'm currently working on a specific idea. If my project would be about generating just big data, like sequencing approaches, or just very global data sets, then I would definitely support the idea of just publishing it beforehand, just because it really is beneficial to a lot of people to have access to these big data sets. Yeah, but I wouldn't publish my own idea.
I would like to finish our so far very interesting discussion with a rather provocative and maybe also a little bit philosophical question. Do you think that we can own ideas and data?
I would differentiate between ideas and data. I think ideas, actually, yes, because normally that's really theories and hypotheses which are, let's say, in your head. But data, I think, is then either proof or not proof of this idea and hypothesis. And I would say that data you can't own. At some point you either publish them or let's say they are gone. But that's what happens often to data, is that if you leave your lab and you generated some nice data but you didn't publish it, often another student takes over and publishes your data then, so it's not your data anymore.
I have exactly the opposite opinion. I think you can't really own ideas. Of course, you have ideas and you can retain your ideas, your thoughts for a specific amount of time, but somewhere on this planet, someone else might have the same idea at some point. Yeah. But I think you can own data, and that's an important point here, because there's often a lot of work behind generating data, and not just work, but also money. It's an investment. It is your data set. You can choose what you want to do with the data. But of course, I also think that it's beneficial for all of us to publish the data as soon as possible.
It's difficult to answer if you can really own an idea, because I don't think that you are the only person on Earth that has this idea.
I don't think so, and if I think Flusser would sit here, he would say the same, because the death of the author. So we are in this era with the Barthian, with the Flusserian thoughts that, of course, if you, I don't know, write a scientific paper and your name is on it, it's definitely your product, I would say, or your scientific work in the end. Which, of course, has some questions about the copyrights and so on, but idea in a sense that who has started and what was the first and so on, I don't believe in this linear histories in the 21st century. It's just not the way.
Thank you for your answers, and thank you for your time.
Hey, you're welcome.
And I thank you very much for taking the time. It was a pleasure.
Thank you very much, Gina.
Thanks, Gina.
Okay, so animatch.eu is where people can get more information about Animatch if they're interested. Thank you very much for the interview, and it was very nice talking to you about open science.
Thank you, too.
Thank you to the interviewers and the interviewees for their contributions, and thank you for listening to this episode on Open Science. Seems like the old concept combined with new technology is already making waves within academia and is set to change the way science is conducted, researchers communicate, and perhaps even the way we define our own ideas. Did you think you had a new idea today?